The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
5 January of 2017, there was really 2 meetings. One, and they were in the same place, Oval Office, with Obama. One had a larger group, and then Obama sent some out, and he kept a smaller group in. And the larger group was Vice President, people like Clapper, Comey, Brennan, Susan Rice, Sally Yates. This is 5 January 2017. So the Obama administration was trying to do everything that they could to undermine everything, basically to usurp the incoming Trump administration. So that meeting in January was a meeting about me. And Obama dismissed most of the people, kept Vice President Clapper, Comey, Brennan, and Susan Rice, and Sally Yates. Sally Yates was the Deputy Attorney General or the Acting Attorney General at the time. And that's when they talked about me. And the very famous Logan Act came up, right? This thing called the Logan Act. Nobody ever heard of it. Biden is the one that recommended the Logan Act. And that was the day to me, 5 January 2017, is a sort of the official start date of the coup led by Barack Obama against the United States of America to undermine a sitting president, a duly elected sitting president of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump. And here we are, August 2023, and we're still in the throes of that coup.
7 years, a rolling coup, as some have put it. And there's your former national security advisor to Donald Trump in office for just a few weeks before the deep state went after him and tried to destroy his career. And that went on for years. They were, as you heard yesterday on the show, I mean, he's been through a lot. We didn't get to cover everything that we wanted to on yesterday's show, but thankfully we kept the cameras rolling after the hour-long show had ended. So today we're going to bring you part 2 of our conversation with General Michael Flynn. You are listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. You can get to the live stream of this show at our website, trumpetdaily.com. And also at our Rumble channel, we had more activity at our Rumble channel yesterday, thanks to the help of General Flynn, who retweeted one of our promos, and I think Rumble was also giving us some publicity as well. Nearly 100,000 people tuned in to watch the first part of our conversation with General Michael Flynn, and today, as I say, we'll bring you part 2. Anyway. The Rumble channel, if you go there today to join in on the conversation, make sure that you leave us a Rumble, a thumbs up. And also, I should mention that you can share the program at our Rumble channel as well. So share and like as much as possible. And with that, actually, I do want to just give you the 800 number as well. If you saw the program yesterday, the general mentioned this book multiple times. And the 800 number that we have to request your free copy of America Under Attack, that is 1-866-930-3024. Of course, you can leave us some feedback at our Rumble channel, or you can send us an email. And we have gotten quite a few emails in the last few days just because of the events surrounding Michael Flynn's visit. And at the end of the show, if we have a few extra minutes, I can maybe give you a brief summary of just some of the things that he and his crew were able to enjoy while on the campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma. So with that, we will continue our conversation with General Michael Flynn. Let's start with your 2010 paper, Fixing Intel. You were in Afghanistan at the time.
I was the senior intelligence officer for the International Security Assistance Force of operating in Afghanistan. And that was my... At that time, that was my third assignment in Afghanistan. So I put in close to almost 3 years there, over 3 years, I think, maybe closer to four.
And what motivated you to produce that paper?
Well, I mean, so there's a couple of other co-authors as well. One was a young Marine at the time, and another was a member of DIA, which I was not part of DIA at that time, a really senior analyst who I knew and worked with. And when we looked at the landscape of what was happening, the larger intelligence community was not answering the needs of what we needed on the battlefield. And, you know, we have this Mongasso multi-billion dollar intelligence community. We have people at war in Afghanistan, and people are dying. Soldiers are dying. It's an international security force. And so I just felt like something we needed to get a message out in a bigger, broader way. And so this paper was written, and Fixing Intel, a blueprint for Afghanistan, basically for fixing intelligence in Afghanistan. And we published it in 2010. And, you know, I'm in Afghanistan as the J2, they call it. And immediately it got all kinds of, I mean, I got all kinds of cards and letters, not in a good way. I mean, within 24 hours. I published it in the Center for New American Security one of the think tanks in Washington, D.C. And a lot of people in the military, and actually a lot of people in the intel community, primarily the intel community, were calling for my head, like fire. And I was like, I'm in Afghanistan. You know, I'm a general at the time. I was a two-star. And I'm like, you know, hey, I'm on the battlefield here, and I'm telling you. But what they want is they want you to you know, do backdoor stuff, where if you do the, which I always did, I always followed the chain of command, always kept pushing and pushing and pushing on the higher intel community and got no response. So I said, you know what, let's put this out there on the street and see what happens. Well, good enough for Secretary Bob Gates, Secretary of Defense at the time. He read it and he said, this is brilliant. We got a war to fight. Let's get back to fighting the war. And then I was able to then begin, because of his sort of premature on the document, which was very helpful. I'm going to sit here. I'm not going to be, I'm not going to lie about it. It was very powerful statement that he did. He basically shut up Washington, D.C. and the bigger intel community, because he's former director of CIA at the time, Secretary of Defense. And so that particular paper, later on in my career, came back to kind of, you know, one, it probably got me in a positive way to be identified as one of the up-and-coming flag officers to take over DIA to fix some of these issues that I do highlight in there, because it's not just fixing intel in Afghanistan. There are tactics, techniques, and procedures inside that document for all kinds of things, for law enforcement activities, for warfare, and for how you run government, mm-hmm. You know, how we run our government. So it's this, you know, like we talked about back in 2010, I'm essentially calling out the fake news, right?
Right.
And
you said that it wasn't intel that was driving policy. It was
the media. Media was driving policy. And, you know, you can say that it wasn't intel to a degree, and that's true. But the intel community, and particularly the CIA, has such influence inside of the media, inside of the mainstream media, inside the, you know, the big networks, right? And then the cable news networks. They have a lot of influence, the intel community. So in a way, it's kind of the chicken and the egg, right? I mean, but the media was definitely driving a lot of our policy, and we were getting it wrong. We were getting it wrong in Afghanistan. This was my third tour there. And now I'm in a bigger position. I'm in a more responsible position, and I felt like the message wasn't getting back to Washington, D.C. And so we published that, and then we began to implement some of that. And I think that the reforms there, a lot of those reforms came from other reforms that I had done previously in other jobs that I had in the military, particularly when I was in the special operations community, where we really had to reform the intelligence procedures and the intelligence system that we had in order to operate at the grassroots level, right? And people will understand the word grassroots, because there's things, if you read this, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. if they read this document, it's still online, it's still one of the most widely read documents, think tank publications ever. So still gets read a lot.
So just coming back to your yeah. position, you're a two-star general.
Right.
Bob Gates supported it. You're an up and coming. And then in right. 2012, you become the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Right.
Now, I think that what's interesting here is 2 years after that, the Obama administration pushed you out.
Sure.
But 2 years before 2014, Obama hired you for that
yeah.
position. Do you think it was Bob Gates, that his influence that maybe...
I think Bob Gates, you know, clearly he's a good man. And I'm, you know, he's said some snarky things, not about me, but about others that I do appreciate. But I think it was Bob Gates, Jim Clapper. Everybody knows the name Jim Clapper, right? Former director of national intelligence. The interesting thing is I was appointed to two really important positions by President Obama. Okay, I was appointed by him. He had to sign on the dotted line to appoint me. So people came in and said, this is the right guy. Obama says, okay, we'll appoint him to 3-star. And they put me into an assistant director of national intelligence for all intelligence relationships, foreign and domestic. And then he appointed me to the Defense Intelligence Agency as the director. And that's Obama appointing me now. And then both of those positions had to be confirmed by the United States Senate. And I was unanimously confirmed to both those positions by the entirety of the Senate.
Right.
So Obama appoints me 2012 to be the director of Defense Intelligence Agency. And 2 years later I forget the exact time frame, but it was roughly February of 2014 when, you know, famous statement by Obama is Bin Laden's dead, Al Qaeda's on the run in the, I think, 2012 time frame. And now we're watching the wars. The wars are continuing to go on. ISIS, to me, I had spent almost five years in fighting, you know, Al Qaeda and ISIS and other terrorists and other enemies around the world. And I'm getting daily reports from the battlefield. I'm getting daily reports from the 3- and 4-star commanders that we have around the world. And I have my own team of really high-end, you know, intel professionals. And I'm getting ready to go into a hearing in front of the United States Senate, which is one of these public hearings to kind of give the worldwide intelligence assessment. And when in a very famous picture of me, Clapper, Brennan, and Comey, and basically during that hearing, we were all asked about ISIS. You know, the administration says ISIS is on the run, you know, words to that effect. And they asked, went right down the line, and I was the last one asked. And they asked each one of them, they said, yeah, ISIS is on the run, we're beating them back, you know. Director of the FBI, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, director of National Intelligence. And then they get to, you know, little old Mike Flynn is director of DIA, which is a big organization. And they asked me, and I said, no. So ISIS is not on the run. They're actually growing. And they're in more countries than they've ever been in. And at that time, our assessment at DIA was that they were, I think we had said that they were in like 24 countries. They weren't just in Iraq or parts of Syria. ISIS was migrating all throughout Central Asia, which is the Central Asian Republics, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all the way through Southwest Asia, and then all the way through what's called the Sahel of Africa, right? The northern tier of the African states, all the way down into almost all the way across the Sahara Desert, down into places like Nigeria, which is on the southwestern coastline. So we had elements of ISIS all over the place, and they were actually in Europe, they were in Indonesia, and we knew that there was resources coming out of the United States of America, particularly financial. So all this is what the intelligence community had, and yet the administration wanted a set of talking points. They wanted a narrative to be adhered to. And that's just not me. It's not
me. This is actually an example of that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the clip 5, President Obama at that time.
4 years ago, I told you I'd end the war in Iraq. And I did. I said we'd end the war in Afghanistan, and we are. I said we'd refocus on the people who actually attacked us on 9/11. And today, Al-Qaeda's on the run, and Osama bin Laden is dead. Al-Qaeda's on the path to defeat and bin Laden is dead. We have gone after Al-Qaeda, decimated their leadership ranks, taken out Osama bin Laden. We've been able to decimate Al-Qaeda.
So you feel like it was your testimony?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. There's no doubt, because much later, it was only a very short period of time after that, days actually, where I was called in with two individuals. One was the Undersecretary of Defense for Intel, and one was Director Clapper. And they basically said, Clapper said to me, essentially, we are removing you from DIA. You know, you're going to be leaving DIA. And I'm like, I'm kind of looking at him. And I say, and I knew exactly why. And I said, I said immediately to Clapper, are you removing me because of my leadership? And he goes, oh, no, I'd cut you off at the knees if it was your leadership. Because I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm the best leader, but I know leadership and I know how to take good care of people. And I've always been, in terms of leading organizations, I've led organizations from platoon to large organizations. So I knew that wasn't it. And when he said that to me, then I knew exactly what it was. And it was because I wasn't, toeing the line. I wasn't kowtowing to that particular message that Obama wanted to have out there, because it's not just about Obama. It's about the future of the country. So when he's talking like that, in his second administration, knowing that he's not going to be able to run for president again, but he wants to set the stage for whoever's going to come in behind him. And in this case, the anointed one of Hillary was going to be the one that was going to come in. And so he's setting the stage. Well, here you got a general, director of Defense Intelligence Agency, a guy who had served years of my life in combat, not a couple of months, but years of my life in combat fighting these guys. And so I had good credibility. I knew what I was talking about. I had looked at the entirety of the situation and all the evidence that we had. And there was no doubt that we were facing an enemy that was actually migrating into something worse. And every bit of intelligence that was going in front of Barack Obama said that. But the message from the leadership was going to be, they're on the run. You know, we've got them down. I'm doing a great job fighting them. And the reality is, we weren't. I mean, here we are. This is August of 2023. 2 years, almost to the date of our complete and total surrender in Afghanistan to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, okay, and to the Taliban. A complete and total surrender. We surrendered under fire, we retreated under fire, and we left American citizens behind, and we, had casualties at the very end that resulted in 13 killed in action, beautiful young Marines primarily, a Navy corpsman, I believe, and a soldier, an Army soldier, and then many, many others wounded in that really fateful day. When does that ever happen to America? And there you go. You got Obama talking all this glorious stuff. That's not how war is. And frankly, you got to be honest in war, because I have been on the battlefield and know that what I was about to say, had to be exactly what I believed. And I believed it because I studied it. I learned it. I felt it. I experienced it, because I was about to say something that was going to cause soldiers to go do something. And when they went and did something, that could result in them being killed, on behalf of this country. But so we have the political level, and I don't want people to sit there and go, well, politicians always lie. We shouldn't accept it, especially in war.
What was the difference between the intel you were getting on Iran and the Barack Obama policy toward Iran?
Yeah, night and day. It's like evil versus good, right? Iran designated number one state sponsor of terrorism on the planet by our own State Department. Members the Iranian military, particularly Soleimani, Qasem Soleimani, was the number one. He was designated by the United States of America as the leading terrorist in the world, right? He's running their component of their military, their special operations component, and it ended up Trump ended up killing him. But Iran at the time, they are killing Americans principally in Iraq. And I think the, you know, these explosively formed projectiles, we call them EFPs, IEDs, became an acronym that everybody got to know about in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, improvised explosive devices. I mean, the Iranians were, they had killed like to the tune of about 500 of our American soldiers. And they're spewing constantly, the Iranian government is constantly spewing hatred, not only of the United States of America, but of Israel. You know, I mean, they're talking about wiping Israel off the map. They're talking about, you know, what we, they call us the great Satan. So all these messages are coming out of Iran. This is not me making this up. Go look it up. And yet Obama is willing to cut a deal to give them uranium, to enrich uranium, to make a nuclear weapon. And then, you know, people like John Kerry, the Secretary of State, second Secretary of State under Obama, and Obama, they're talking about, well, this is, you know, it'll take 10 years. You know, I won't go crazy Irish, but baloney, right? I mean, baloney. The intent of the Iranian regime is to have a nuclear weapon, and further that intent, it's to destroy Israel. And Israel, as far as I'm concerned, and I describe Israel as this bastion of democracy and freedom in this cauldron of smoking hot coals, right? You know, called the Middle East. And it's the greater Middle East. It's not just the Middle East where we think about Iraq and Saudi and Yemen and Dubai and some of these other, you know, Kuwait. You know, it's also the extra regional players going from Egypt all the way down to Somalia, all the way into upwards into Turkey, and of course over into other parts where we talked about Afghanistan. So Israel is this like example of freedom, example of justice, example of democracy, and we have to protect that we have to protect that relationship. And here Iran is trying, is they're stating we're going to take it, we're going to wipe it off the face of the planet.
Right.
And we're going to give these guys the ability to have nuclear weapons? I mean, it just doesn't pass the common sense test. So I was pushing back on that while I was in uniform, and I'm doing it the right, you know, through the right channels, and people knew it. And then when I got out, I went and testified to a hearing in summer of 2015. After I was out, I'm an expert on a variety of subjects, and one of them is this. And so one of the committees of the House that was looking at this, and I think it was like June or July of 2015, if I got the month right, I was asked to come in to testify, and I did in an open hearing about Iran. And I made a statement, and I had a statement that I turned in, and it was really, it was against the Iranian nuclear deal. And after I came out of the military, you know, I took a stand against it because I'm still looking at this and I'm going, we're given millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in some cases, and we're going to give uranium that can be enriched into a nuclear weapon, we're going to give it to Iran. And even at the time that the administration was giving Iran money and giving them this capability, they were still listed by our State Department as the leading state sponsor of terrorism. I mean, if that's not the definition of insanity, I don't know what is. So
you're giving that testimony. That's, you said summer of
2015.
Okay, so Donald Trump comes down the escalator that summer as well. And at what point along that campaigning did you start looking at Donald Trump and saying, well, hey, I need to throw my support behind him?
Well, I was asked by multiple candidates, actually, because I really didn't want to get involved in politics. But when people asked me about, hey, can you come in? I mean, Ben Carson asked me. Carly Fiorino asked me. Trump asked me to visit him in August, I think. It was August of 2015. I went up to New York, or down in New York from where I was, I think. And I visited him, and we spent a couple hours together. It was only supposed to be about, you know, a 30-minute introduction. And we spent a couple hours together. And I actually also met Eric Trump, who's a wonderful young man, during that meeting. And we had a talk about the landscape of the world. And there was a lot of things that we had in common in terms of, you know, what he saw as the problems that America faced. So we hit it off. Great, great initial conversation. I kind of went back to doing what I was doing, which I was going around speaking and trying to just, you know, think about what I wanted to sort of do in life after coming out of almost 3.5 decades of the military. And but I stayed in touch with his campaign. And around probably early winter of 2016, they reached, you know, and I had been talking to Corey Lewandowski at the time, who was his campaign manager. I'd talked to him probably once a week and others. But I when I talked to they got a hold of me in summer of or winter of 2016. And I basically, they asked me, would you join our team? And I said, sure. You know, here's kind of, you know, my ground rules, and because I'm always very blunt. And I felt like my relationship with Trump was one of respect. It was really, he was a very good guy. You know, I asked him, what should I call you? And he says, call me Donald, you know, until he became the president. Then I called him president, right? And he always called me, always referred to me as general. And I just, I appreciated that because he was very respectful. And he really, really does, I mean, he deeply cares about this country, but he loves the military. And so I started to be more of an active participant in his campaign. And then in June of 2016, I got a call and they told me I was being vetted for Vice President of the United States. And
really?
And the final four candidates were myself, Chris Christie, Newt Gingrich, and Mike Pence. And there's a couple of, it was like right before the 4th of July weekend is when the decisions were being made, because it was right before the convention. And so, you know, they called me up and they asked me for some information, you know, just stuff to vet you on, you know. So I'd been, my life had been vetted, because you get the clearances I had, the security clearances I had, you get vetted all the way, you know, up and down. So that was easy. So I provided it to them. And at the time, you know, I've only been a registered Republican for 2 years, a little over 2 years now, but let's just say 2 years. At the time, I was a Democrat. So, but I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't one of these guys that wore it on my sleeve. I wasn't, you know, I was just, you know, I believed in the country and I believed in the direction that Donald Trump was taking the country. And so I was honored to be asked to even be considered. And so the other three were, you know, hardcore Republicans, right? And, you know, I'll name the names again, Gingrich, Christie, and Pence. And, you know, you look at those three today and the kinds of things that they're saying and the kinds of things that they won't say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and here I am. So when we look at ideologies, when we look at Democrats and Republicans, I don't, those are gone. I mean, I look at, you either are an American and you believe in the American way of life, or you are part of this globalist elite group of people, and many of them are in our federal government. And to me, that's the direction of our country. Those are the two paths. You know, one is, you know, as I explained in another conversation, one is what can be accepting that easy light at the end of that valley, and that means they're gonna give you something. They're gonna give you money. They're gonna give you power. They're gonna give you control. Or it's the harder. It's the other light. It's the harder path. It's the path of sacrifice. Kind of like what I've been talking about: getting involved in your community, doing more for your families, doing more for your local counties, right? Getting involved. So
when you spoke at the Republican convention, mm-hmm. did you have a pretty good idea that they were going to give you some kind of a position?
No, I didn't. And I didn't expect anything.
Did you know by that point that he went a different direction for VP? Well, I guess.
He called me up. Oh, yeah. Okay. Donald Trump called me up before the convention. He called me up and we, you know, as we always did on the phone, we joked about some stuff. We talked about, you know, what was going on. We talked about how he was being just assaulted in the media when they used to, you know, absolutely, you know, think he was, you know, the cat's meow all the time before he got involved in politics, right? So, yeah, we kidded on the phone, and I said, hey, whatever, Mr. You know, I said, whatever, Donald, at the time, you know, I'm going to help you. I'm here to help. And, you know, whatever decision you make, and he told me what decision he was going to make. He goes, tomorrow I'm going out to see Mike Pence, and I'm going to pick Mike Pence as my vice president. And that's, you know, that's okay.
Yeah,
and it worked, right? I mean, he became the president of the United States in 2016, and I hope that I did in some small ways help him get there. But
So we have, this is General Flynn at the Republican convention in the summer of 2016, clip one.
Tonight, America stand as one with strength and confidence to overcome the last 8 years of the Obama-Clinton failures, such as bumbling indecisiveness, willful ignorance, and total incompetence that has challenged the very heart and soul of every American and single-handedly brought continued mayhem, murder, and destruction into our neighborhoods and onto the world's streets.
Yeah, six so, at the old cat night. That was hard to get through that one.
He was as sick as a dog that night.
Now I'll tell you, that speech, they, you know, for a variety of reasons, those words, they really have come after me because of that. Because they know as a general, you know, you stand, and it's like people go, oh, generals shouldn't be involved in politics. What about General Grant? What about General Eisenhower? What about General Washington? I mean, right. You know, so give me a break.
Well, total incompetence.
Yeah.
And has challenged the very heart of every American, single-handedly brought continued mayhem. I mean, that's strong.
Well, it's very strong language, and it's very purposeful.
Yeah.
And it's intentional. And I mean, so you tell me, you know, for this audience, you look around at our cities in this country, you look around at our border, you look at every kind of indicator of existence in America today, and you can't tell me that things are rosy, okay? I mean, shutting down churches, shutting down small businesses, allowing millions of illegals, the rising crime rate, all these things. Our education system is horrific. So, it's incompetence.
Right.
It is sheer incompetence. Or it's willful negligence.
So Trump shocks the world in November 2016. Yep. And then you had all the media reporting on Obama having the little sit down. Well, I think it was November 10th, 2 days after the election.
Right.
Obama has the meeting with him. He gives him those strong warnings. And then this is how the regime media reported on that, clip seven.
Well, I just had the opportunity to have an excellent conversation with President-elect Trump.
Back on November 10th, an important date, that is when President Obama sat down with then President-elect Trump for their very important private meetings. President Obama warned President Trump against hiring Michael Flynn as his national security advisor, warned him personally and directly during that meeting in the Oval Office on November 10th.
President Obama offered then-President-elect Trump a clear warning. Don't hire retired General Michael Flynn as national security advisor.
President Obama had warned President Donald Trump against hiring Michael Flynn as his national security advisor.
During that 90-minute Oval Office meeting that took place with President Obama here at the White House, less than 48 hours after President Trump won, when he was then President-elect Trump, was warned by President Obama against hiring Mike Flynn. This President Obama, at the time, it was on Thursday, November 10th, warned then-President-elect Donald Trump against hiring Mike Flynn.
President Obama warned then-President-elect Trump about Flynn.
Then-President Obama said explicitly, do not hire this man. This is a problem. I fired him for a reason. This is going to cause you grief.
Stay away from Michael Flynn. He's bad news.
So unbelievable. You know, the words that you heard them all parrot, and I use parrot precisely, warned against. So it's like, here's the talking point, and run with this talking point to make sure that we're going to go after Flynn, okay? And it's not just the Trump administration or the Obama administration, because I'll go through talk about this 5 January meeting, which I think is really important. It's when I believe the coup started. But warned against, and why? You know, you got to say why. What were they so afraid of? They're afraid of the things that I said in this blueprint. They're afraid of the things that I warned against when it talked about Iran. They're afraid of people that stand up and tell the truth. And, you know, so they will persecute you for that. And there's also a uniparty inside of Washington, D.C. And that uniparty was part of this. It wasn't just the Obama administration. There was people on both sides of the aisle, particularly the establishment, who benefits from having having something called endless wars, right? The endless wars, which I am against, we have a purpose for our military, and it's to fight and win our nation's wars, not participate forever. So from that meeting, and I went back and I saw Trump afterwards, and he asked me, we were joking about it, because he's like, can you believe this?
Well, because in the same meeting, he was warning about
Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, right? The guys that's firing, missiles on Obama's head. He's just firing missiles all the time.
So the North Korean dictator,
right,
and General Michael Flynn.
Yeah, who served his country. I served my country. I served the United States. I had a terrific, I loved being in the military and serving and had a great career. And I'd go back, I'd go back.
So what did President Trump say on the phone with you? So,
well, on the phone, it was actually in a face-to-face meeting. It was a face-to-face meeting we had. And he said, it was right after. And he said, can you believe this? Obama said, and I was like, we were laughing about it. And I said to him, I've never met the guy. I mean, so for people that listen to this, I never met him. And so when you were going to say something about like that, so the transition of the United States of America from the outgoing president to the incoming president, so many massive things to talk about. And it was a very short conversation, right? So many massive things to talk about. And Obama focuses on those two points, right? And Trump was able to quash the threat from North Korea. Everybody saw that, a very famous meeting. And he ended up saying to me, he goes, you want to be the national security advisor? And I said, yeah. He goes, you got the job. That was the meeting. We were joking about it, but it was surreal, because later on, fast forward, that was in November. So a lot of these things other things hadn't occurred. So now the fifth, a very famous meeting of five January of 2017, there was really two meetings. One, and they were in the same place, Oval Office, with Obama. One had a larger group, and then Obama sent some out, and he kept a smaller group in. And the larger group was Vice President, people like Clapper, Comey, Brennan, Susan Rice, Sally Yates. There were some other minions in the room, his chief of staff. And there was a couple of other key people in that room. It's probably and we have notes of all this. We have the minutes of all this. This is all came out evidence in my case.
And this is all just 2 weeks before President Trump.
5 January 2017. So the Obama administration was trying to do everything that they could to undermine everything. They undermined, basically, to usurp the incoming Trump administration. So that meeting in January was a meeting about me. And Obama dismissed most of the people, kept Vice President Clapper, Comey, Brennan, and Susan Rice, and Sally Yates. Sally Yates was the deputy attorney general, or the acting attorney general at the time. And that's when they talked about me. And this is the very famous, the outcome of this. We have these notes that say, what's our goal here? To get him to lie or to get him fired? What's our goal, right? And the very famous Logan Act came up, right? This thing called the Logan Act. Nobody ever heard of it. Biden is the one that recommended the Logan Act. And then later on, he said he denied that he even talked about it. And then he was, on a break with George Stephanopoulos. They had to come back to him. I don't know if you remember that. And they had to come back to him and say, oh, yeah, I did. I might have said some things. But that was the day, to me, 5 January 2017 is sort of the official start date of the coup led by Barack Obama against the United States of America to undermine a duly elected sitting president of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump. And here we are, August 2023, however many years that is, 6 years, almost 6 years, more than 6 years later. And we're still in the throes of that coup.
Still in the throes of that coup. Fascinating detail brought to you by someone who was a true insider. He mentioned even some of the legal briefs that went back and forth when the government was coming after him. And even on the trip out here, just talking to him on the plane, you heard some of it there. I couldn't believe how many details he had just fresh on his memory as he's recounting the coup, the real insurrection that's been going on now for, as he said, more than 6 years, 7 years, all of that. And more is written about in the book that he plugged yesterday on this very show, America Under Attack. America is under attack. And we've been talking about this, well, even back before that crucial transition from Barack Obama to Donald Trump back at the end of 2016 and 2017. If you'd like to delve into so many of those fascinating details, make sure that you call our operators today and request your free copy. There's no cost, no obligation. We just want to get it out to as many people as we can, the largest audience possible. The 800 number, that's 1-866-930-3024. Don't forget to give us a thumbs up if you're watching the show right now on Rumble. Leave us a comment. Share the video if you can. Excuse me, if you can. And also the email address if you want to send in some feedback. It's td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
What has happened to the United States of America? The wealthiest, most powerful nation in human history is suddenly divided, weakened, radical. The evil in America has grown powerful. The good has grown weak. The honorable parts of American history are succumbing to a direct, targeted, sustained assault. Someone, something is dismantling America's history, purpose, and character.
Fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Political dysfunction, social strife, economic peril, catastrophic moral failure, fires, attacks, riots, lies. The nation is being attacked from within by its own leaders. Powerful elites in government, journalism, academia, and beyond are intentionally, rapidly destroying what America is in order to make it into something else. There is a reason why your nation is crumbling before your eyes. There is a spirit and a specific perpetrator that is attempting to blot out America. Only America Under Attack reveals that perpetrator and the motive and spirit behind him. This newly expanded book shows you the reason why America has changed so dramatically, so suddenly. If you're confused and concerned about what is happening to America, request your free copy of America Under Attack by Gerald Fleury at thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
All right, and welcome back to the show. We still have a little bit more. What you heard there before we broke away for a promo was what he said near the end of his interview with me yesterday. In fact, when we left, we were hoping we might even get another short segment or two with him because we got through to the start of the coup, January 5, 2017. But there's really so much more to this story, even the story about Mr. Flynn himself and the DOJ unleashing this attack and the setup by the perjury trap by the FBI agents. I mean, that's talked about in Chapter 6 of America Under Attack. So if you want those details, it's certainly there. There's other books out there, one called Framing Flynn, that go into a lot of detail. We produced that introductory video that we played last Friday on the program, and we're hoping to tweet that out pretty soon again as well, just to bring everyone right up to date with some of this history that really doesn't even go back that many years. But the start of the coup, as he said there, January 5, 2017. Let's pick it up where we left off before the break.
That was the day, to me, 5 January 2017 is a sort of the official start date of the coup, led by Barack Obama against the United States of America to undermine a sitting president, a duly elected sitting president of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump. And here we are, August 2023, however many years that is, 6 years, almost 6 years, more than 6 years later. And we're still in the throes of that coup. And I believe it. I mean, now we have to be constitutional. We have to be lawful. We have to be peaceful. We have to be thoughtful about how do we get out of this mess. You know, I mean, Obama's the one that said, I would love to be a third term, but just not have to have all the heartache, right? All the nitinoid stuff that you got to be as a president, right? I'd love to have a third term. And he also used the phrase, fundamentally change America, right? We're going to fundamentally change America. Well, this is what it means. This is what it means. So, you know, all of this stuff and all the things around the interview with the FBI agents and you know, and others, because they're the moment of resignation with President Trump, you know, Mike Pence could have said, I actually apologized to Mike Pence prior. Mike Pence could have said, you know what? Mike and I spoke about it. Mike Flynn and I spoke about it. I accept his apology. You know, we got a country to run, right? Let's let bygones be bygones. Let's move forward. And no. So, you know, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. It's something my mother taught me. And so I'll say nasty things about people, but I think the worst people that we have are in our political system, honestly. I mean, especially those that have been around there for a long time. And I think the worst of the worst are people who fake their faith. So those people that fake their faith, to me, and are in politics, they're the worst people that we can have leading our country. And, you know, you can't pretend. And frankly, you can't pretend with the American people. There's no pretending with the American people. And the beauty of our country is just the God-given common sense that just regular old Americans have. And I like to think of myself in that category. And so, you know, naive, yep. Politically naive, definitely. Would I want to wish this on my worst enemies? No. You know, would I stand up for my family? Again, you bet. I will go to the gates to defend my family. And so that's kind of where I'm at. And I think where our country's at and what we need right now is we need strong leaders. We need people who are of the belief that this is still the greatest country on the planet. And I think we need to focus on those leaders who will move us forward in a direction that you know that sees America as it is supposed to be, right? Again, the sort of the shining city on a hill. So thank you very much for allowing me some time.
General Flynn, it's been a privilege Great. And an honor to have you Great. On the show. We have so much more. I didn't even get to your books. You got to come back.
That's right. We'll come back. I'll come back.
Speaking of his books, that was another segment, a short segment that we wanted. I apologize to him for not getting into those. He brought the one he wrote last year, The Fifth Generation Warfare. It's a citizen's guide. So just some really, it's a small book, but it's just filled with lots of practical tips, even about just protecting our children from Big Brother. They're snooping into every device that we use these days. And so that came out last year. And then he has the sequel to it, which is about twice as big, which was only just released this week. I forget the title of that offhand. So there's more to talk to. There's more to read and study for sure. We certainly appreciate General Flynn really packing in his schedule. Yesterday, it kind of got lost in all of the activities with the interviews and so on. But he also sat down or rather spoke to our Imperial Academy students, many of them just teenagers. And he took a Q&A session there. And he talked about leadership. He talked about the importance of humility. He talked about just the basics of being kind to other people, saying yes, sir, saying yes, ma'am, saying please, saying thank you, all the kinds of things that we've actually got in our imperial code of conduct. So our IA principal was happy to give him one of those little booklets, and he was happy to give our students some materials on the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and so on. So it was definitely an educational experience for so many of our young people as well. Quite a few people online very excited about the events of these past few days. One writes from overseas, "I've been waiting for this event since March or April. Great program on Monday." Another one here says, "Thank you so very much. I was so inspired and encouraged by your interview with General Flynn this morning." And then another one says, "What an awesome show with General Flynn. It was terrific. He really is a true patriot, and his talk about everything from faith to family to friends is spot on with America under attack." It says, "You have outdone yourself with the Trumpet Daily this time for certain." Appreciate that encouragement, that feedback. Another one here says, "What an awesome day it was yesterday to see General Flynn on the Trumpet Daily and how he endorsed America under attack. Then the evening live stream of his speech and Q&A, did you note that he mentioned Psalm 23, which is what the campers at SEP were memorizing?" It says here, "Sounds like he felt right at home at headquarters." Another one says here, "Wow, it's hard for me to express into words how inspiring the TD and live broadcast of General Flynn's lecture at headquarters was for me. His lecture really reinforced for me the importance of leadership and sacrifice." Leadership and sacrifice, it stands in stark contrast to what you're seeing, to what you often see on the first segment of this daily program. I should have brought the clip with me, but there's that statement that the fake president made in Hawaii yesterday, where he was talking about how his house nearly burned down, how he nearly lost his Corvette in a fire. This was like a little kitchen stove fire that was put out in 20 minutes, and it's the AP reported on it back in 2004. So here comes this fake president lying, basically. He's trying to console all of these victims. There have been entire families that have burned to death in this inferno. And you've got Joe Biden over there joking about nearly losing his 1967 Corvette. There's leaders, quote unquote, like that all over the place. And then you get one that actually has some leadership ability. And what happens? Well, they become a prey, like the Bible says. They become a target. Satan really goes after him, tries to blot him out. We've seen that happen time and again as well. This viewer says, "I also want to congratulate all those at headquarters for their hard work and dedication to making Mr. Flynn's visit memorable for everyone. I've been in the PCG for almost 30 years and have watched the work grow, remembering that little mustard seed, beginning with television broadcasting, and now, wow, how professional all of you are." It really was a mustard seed beginning. Even everything that the general's entourage was able to see, they were just kind of blown away at the beauty and at the peace of this campus. But it's been, as one of them said, it's been a vision that was laid out there back, 23, 24 years ago. And today you look at it, and I mean, it's spectacular. One more comment says, I thought General Flynn would bore me, but he didn't, not a bit. It's brought to my attention my love of good men. I want to be in their presence more." He is certainly not boring, this man, who's had so many life experiences as he's served his country for over three decades. And like I said, it's like it's right at the top of his head if you ask him about that transition from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. He really was a true insider and has a fascinating story to tell. Well, that's all that we have time for on this program. We certainly thank you for joining our growing Rumble audience, our growing audience at our website, TrumpetDaily.com. We'll look forward to talking to you again tomorrow. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.